Test, test. Test, test, test. Ah, that's good. Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41. It's October 25th. And let's see, you got a test coming up sometime. This is the last lecture before the test, so I think the test will be 1 week from today. Right, is that what we said last time? Yeah, 1 week from today. So today's a Tuesday. I don't have the date handy because I booted up the PowerPoint program, but we could probably at November 1st. Wow, holy cow. Okay, November 1st. Is that true? Oh, yeah. Because otherwise it would be the 32nd. There's not 32 days. Okay, so we were talking about second messengers, how some hormones cause their effect inside cells. So here is a really hard question. Here we have a hormone, all right, and I'm not going to describe what's going on here on this slide at all. What can you tell me about this hormone? Something about the physical chemistry of that hormone right there. Okay, just the hormone, not the receptor. But the receptor, that's a hint, that's a clue to what I'm asking. Where is that receptor located? By looking at the location of that receptor, you should be able to tell me something about that hormone. It is hydrophilic. You're really close, really close. Because hydrophilic substances can't get through what the plasma membrane, so it has to have extracellular receptors. All right, so that also means since the receptor is extracellular, how does the thing that's trapped outside the cell, namely the hormone, how does it exert its effects inside the cell if it can't get in? It's got to work through what kind of mechanism? A second messenger system, right? And this G protein coupled receptor is that mechanism that allows for that signal transduction, how a signal outside the cell turns into a signal inside the cell, which causes some change in physiology inside the cell. Or maybe you could think of maybe it changes the biochemistry inside the cell, which is the same thing as changing the physiology. That's why I always like people to take a chemistry class before taking a physiology class. Okay, this particular mechanism operates through phospholipase C enzyme. All right, so what's the substrate for phospholipase? Because how do you know this is an enzyme? Because there's an ASC, and also the substrate is incorporated into the name of this enzyme, right? And so the substrate is what? A phospholipid. Where's your favorite place for phospholipids? Plasma membrane, because that's the basic building block of the plasma membrane, is a phospholipid. So let's take a look at this. I think we went over this last time really quickly. All right, so here is the hormone. It's a hydrophilic hormone. It binds to an extracellular receptor, all right, and binds to the receptor, which then activates the G protein. These G protein subunits, remember what, there's an alpha, beta, and gamma subunit, and these dissociate, and maybe it's the alpha subunit wanders around inside the plasma membrane, bumps into phospholipase C, which then, what can you tell me about phospholipase C? Yeah, it's hydrophobic because it's inside the cell membrane right here. But it's probably like the third or fourth phospholipase that somebody discovered, right? There's probably a phospholipase A and B, and this is like the third one inside this membrane. So this is like a lipid world, right? That is still a living component of cells inside the plasma membrane. And then down over here would be what kind of world? This would be like water world inside the cell, cytoplasm. Right, is dissolved in water, but everything that's dissolved inside the plasma membrane has to be lipid, so this is like a special little place where life exists inside a lipid environment. Phospholipase C becomes activated when the G protein binds to it on that active site, changes the conformation of this enzyme, and then it has plenty of substrates right here, phospholipid and phospholipase C, makes an acetyl 3-phosphate. You don't have to know the structure. As a matter of fact, you should just know that it's IP3. I just call it IP3. IP3 then becomes the signaling molecule that is located where? Inside the cell, intracellular. Okay, and then IPE3 diffuses around inside the cytoplasm, bumps into smooth endoplasmic reticulum. You could modify your notes to put smooth endoplasmic reticulum right here. Because what's the function of rough ER? Protein synthesis, right? But smooth ER was for lipid synthesis, but it also is a storage place for calcium ions. So when IPE3 bumps into this smooth ER right here, it causes the release or the opening of calcium channels, and then calcium floods the inside of the cell. All right, and then so calcium becomes a signaling molecule as well. It changes the activity inside the cell somehow. We're going to see how that happens in just a couple slides. All right, so what do we call this hormone in terms of this signal transduction scheme? First messenger. All right, and give me an example of a second messenger on this slide right here. Would be IPE3 or calcium. Both of those would be second messengers, and these build up inside the cell as a result of the first messenger binding to this extracellular receptor, or the receptor in the plasma membrane that is extracellular. Okay, there's another second messenger that can also be built up inside the cell, and that's diacylglycerate. And so we just call that DAG. So you should know that IPE3 and DAG can be second messengers that activate various kinds of or changes of biochemistry inside the cell. So another example of a second messenger would be DAG. That's what I want you to know about that. Now what about calcium? Calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm and it binds to another molecule called calmodulin. Maybe you even had calmodulin on the test last time as an exam figure. Right? Calmodulin likes to bind calcium, and then when it binds calmodulin, that can activate or inactivate other enzymes inside the cell. And for instance, if it activates a protein kinase, what does that do? What does a kinase do? It phosphorylates, it uses an ATP, right? It breaks down to ADP. That one inorganic phosphate then is bound to an enzyme, and that's like poking your friend in the side. What's going to happen to your friend once you poke them in the side? Change conformation, so now maybe it has a more proper active site, so that it can bind a substrate that is going to activate that enzyme when it changes conformation, or maybe it will change the active site so it doesn't bind substrate. Thereby, it's going to inactivate that enzyme. So it's going to change the biochemistry inside the cell. That works through calmodulin, and this cal comes from what? Calcium ions right here. That's how it was named. So that's enough of the theoretical stuff. Let's look at some biochemistry that you're familiar with already, and it has to do with blood glucose homeostasis. Okay, and you know a whole bunch of pathways involved with glucose, like you know glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, right? Glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, right? So you should be familiar with all these pathways. Well, how are all those processes regulated in the liver to maintain blood glucose concentration within a normal range suitable to support life? So this red area right here is a liver cell, and we see some biochemistry inside this liver cell. Namely, we have glycogen, right? And tell me something about glycogen. What do you know about glycogen? What's the building block of glycogen? Glucose, yeah? So it's just a storage form of glucose inside of a liver cell. And liver cells are kind of interesting because they're sort of altruistic. They can break down glycogen into glucose, and then they're happy to release that glucose into the blood. All other cells, once they import glucose into them, they'll never release it into the blood. They'll just use it for their own purposes. But the liver cell, right, will actually give up glucose to the blood. So glycogen can be broken down into glucose, right? But you see glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate right here. What does that mean? That glycogen has to be phosphorylated, okay? And so one glucose gets chopped off. So what kind of enzyme is necessary to convert glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate? What do you use? What kind of enzyme phosphorylates something? A kinase, right? And so that would be like glucose 1-phosphatase would do that. All right, and then it's got to be rearranged. That phosphate has to be put into a different position and then dephosphorylated to free glucose, and then this liver cell will release glucose into the blood. Under what kind of conditions will that happen? When will the liver release glucose into the blood? What makes sense? When blood glucose is low, right? For instance, or under stressful circumstances when you need a lot of glucose to run muscles. All right, so what do we call this process of glycogen being, or glucose coming from glycogen? That's glycogenolysis, and that should be controlled. That shouldn't just happen willy-nilly in the cell all the time. And that's under the influence of epinephrine. All right, and epinephrine comes primarily from the adrenal medulla under the fight and flight circumstances. All right, so that's going to have a tendency to elevate blood glucose. So there are two receptors. That's such an important process to maintain blood glucose levels under stressful situations that there are two adrenergic receptors. There's a beta adrenergic receptor and over here an alpha adrenergic receptor. And these are extracellular receptors. They work through two different mechanisms. The beta adrenergic, when epinephrine binds to a beta adrenergic receptor, then that's going to, probably through a G protein, it's going to bump into adenylate cyclase and activate adenylate cyclase. What's the job of adenylate cyclase? It converts ATP to cyclic AMP, right? So epinephrine is the first messenger. What's the second messenger in this system? Cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP concentrations increase. So even one epinephrine molecule can create thousands of cyclic AMPs inside the cell. What would you use to explain that circumstance to me? Why is it that only one epinephrine can cause a buildup of thousands of cyclic AMPs inside the cell? Yeah, because adenylate cyclase is an enzyme. It doesn't get used up during the reaction, right? So this is what a step of this is a signal transduction scheme, but there's also what a step of amplification, signal amplification, because adenylate cyclase is an enzyme. So now we have cyclic AMP, and that's going to activate a protein kinase. And what do you need to chop off a glucose from glycogen and phosphorylate it at the same time? You need a protein kinase, right? So that's going to activate glycogenolysis. That's through the beta adrenergic receptor. But the liver also has alpha adrenergic receptors. But this one works through a different mechanism. Instead of cyclic AMP being a second messenger, what is the second messenger that builds up with the alpha adrenergics right here? It's going to be calcium, right? And I see calcium coming from the outside of the cell. So calcium channels open up. And you should know that calcium is at a high concentration outside the cell, so calcium enters the cell. In this particular case, it's not coming from smoothie art, but it's an extracellular source. It binds to calmodulin. Calmodulin is going to activate a different kind of protein kinase, but the effect is going to be the same. It's going to stimulate glycogenolysis, right, and make glucose 6-phosphate, which then can become free glucose that can go into the blood and, as a result, will raise blood glucose levels under stressful circumstances. All right, so here's a pretty good example of all those things that we talked about in a nice straightforward scheme. All right, so you got both beta-adrenergic and alpha-adrenergic receptors boosting blood glucose levels under a condition of stress. All right, anybody have a question about that kind of mechanism, right? So that's just a really nice example of how biochemistry inside a cell changes, all right, as a result of binding of hormones to surface receptors. All right, so here is another example of a hormone binding to a surface receptor. And again, it has to do with blood glucose homeostasis. And probably even more importantly, when blood glucose decreases, where does glucose go? How come it decreases in the blood? Because it gets absorbed by cells, right? It gets transported into cells. But most cells need a passport in order for glucose to get inside. Glucose just can't flow through the plasma membrane. There has to be some special kind of transporter that gets activated. And I think we talked about the GLUT4 transporter system before, okay? And the passport signal is insulin. And insulin is a hydrophilic hormone. So can insulin enter the cell if it's hydrophilic? It can't, right? So there has to be an extracellular receptor. And the receptor is a tyrosine kinase receptor. Tyrosine kinase receptors are not as common as G protein coupled receptors. It's kind of a newer model of a receptor, but it's used for a number of different kinds of systems inside the body besides blood glucose. All right, but it can also cause cellular effects, like anabolic effects, growth effects inside cells. So a tyrosine kinase receptor has two subunits. You can see that this protein goes from the outside of the cell all the way, it's a transmembrane protein, to the inside of the cell. And when insulin is present, it can bind to these two HAP sites, and then it will dimerize this protein, tyrosine kinase receptor, it will come together. So here is the insulin. And dimerization then activates an ATPase on the intracellular side of the tyrosine kinase receptor. So this tyrosine kinase becomes phosphorylated, and when it does, then it becomes a kinase enzyme. When protein molecules, certain kinds of proteins, then bump into this, it's activated because it has a phosphate and an insulin, then a tyrosine amino acid within that protein can be phosphorylated. And when it becomes phosphorylated, it changes the metabolism inside the cell. Right, so it's going to phosphorylate, so this is going to be a protein, and this phosphate right here is on some kind of tyrosine amino acid within the protein, and then it changes the activity of this protein. It causes a number of different kinds of effects inside the cell. Alright, so I want you to know this tyrosine kinase receptor right here. So let's take a look at one particular example of how it changes activity inside the cell. All right, so here we have a typical cell. We're missing a lot of organelles, of course, but this is just a cell. And here is a tyrosine kinase receptor. And give me an example of what hormone binds to a tyrosine kinase receptor. Insulin. Yeah, so here we have insulin. So that's just one particular example, but we're just going to study this one example right here. All right, so it becomes phosphorylated when insulin binds to these, when it dimerizes. All right, and then this becomes a tyrosine kinase. So when certain protein molecules bump into this enzyme right here, they will be phosphorylated, again, at the expense of an ATP molecule. But that causes the buildup of signaling molecules inside the cell. And you could consider these second messengers. I won't give you any examples. And this is still the effort of a lot of research to find out exactly what process is happening here. All right, so these things get activated. Now, here is something that we realize. We have a number of vesicles deep inside the cell with GLUT4 transporters already synthesized. They're ready to go to work, right? They're in the vesicle membrane. These are membrane-bound organelles inside the cell. When these signaling molecules build up inside the cell, it causes the translocation of these vesicles to the plasma membrane. They fuse to the plasma membrane. But what else goes along with these membrane, the phospholipid bilayer, when this vesicle right here binds to the plasma membrane? There are some proteins that get inserted into the membrane, which are these GLUT4 transporters. And this allows for just facilitated diffusion of glucose from high concentration outside the cell to low concentration inside the cell. And these are the GLUT4 transporters. And does anybody remember the special name that we gave these vesicles right here? I think I talked about them way back when. These are what we call endosomes. All right, so endosomes control the routing of these activated membrane components from an inactive form in a reservoir in an endosome, okay, to being placed in the plasma membrane. And when they're placed in the plasma membrane, then facilitated diffusion can take place of glucose going from high to low concentration inside the cell. And there are other enzymes that continually take the GLUT4 transporters and put them back into these endosomes. So again, there's a balance between when insulin is causing the fusion of these endosomes to the plasma membrane and when they're put back into the cytoplasm. All right, so what's the hormone that causes the fusion of these endosomes or the activation of these GLUT4 transporters that are kind of like in a reservoir formation in an endosome to place them in the cell membrane so that glucose can be imported into the cell? It's insulin. Yeah, that's an insulin signal. All right, so sometimes this does not happen. All right, glucose can't enter some cells for a number of reasons. And you, in lab, you explore some of those different kinds of reasons or certain kinds of pathological conditions. But generally, what do we call it when somebody can't import glucose into their cells, like muscle cells or kidney cells or retinal cells? And what happens to those cells when they can't take up glucose? Well, they die. Yeah, they starve to death, basically. Okay, so what's that general pathology called?
Diabetes.
Yeah, diabetes mellitus. And there's different kinds of diabetes mellitus. For instance, maybe somebody's pancreas isn't making insulin, right, to activate the system right here. That's one kind, but there could be other reasons as well. Maybe somebody's insulin is normal, but maybe this receptor is abnormal or is functionally abnormally. That's a different kind of diabetes mellitus. Or maybe this process of inserting the endosomes into the plasma membrane is defective, right? That's a different kind of diabetes mellitus, and, right, the proper treatment, you have to understand which is which. Because if somebody has normal insulin levels, then by giving them additional insulin, that won't help their condition whatsoever, right? All right, so how could you help somebody that has normal insulin levels? What could you tell somebody? This is a fascinating thing. I don't know if it mentions, I think it mentions it in the book if you read the chapter already. If somebody has normal insulin levels in their body, but they're still a diabetic, how can they help themselves out? Okay, by exercise. Because you know what exercise does? Just the process of exercising a muscle causes the fusion of these endosomes right here that have these GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane, so then that cell, that active muscle cell, can take up glucose and thereby reduce somebody's blood glucose levels back down to a normal level. Okay? So, and then again, also restricted glucose in the diet will also help, so diet and exercise is also very important. So certain kinds of diabetes are helped dramatically by exercise. But not all of them. That's right. Yeah, it will help. I don't know how best to talk about it. Okay. It would probably take me a couple of weeks to talk about that stuff. Okay. But if it's an insulin-independent kind of diabetes, okay, then exercise definitely will help because it puts these transporters in the cell membranes of muscle cells, reducing blood glucose. Okay. So I find that a fascinating alternative to what? Insulin shots, for instance. Okay? Just a bit of exercise. Okay, so that's the tyrosine kinase receptor mechanism. Let's go to a pituitary gland. We're going to go back to the pancreas, which is where insulin comes from in just a little bit. But let's look at the pituitary gland. And so here's the pituitary gland. Have a picture, a sagittal section of a brain in your mind when we look at this slide right here. So here's the hypothalamus. What would be in the brain right about up over here? That would be the thalamus, right? Then down below the thalamus is the hypothalamus. So this is part of the brain. It's neuronal tissue. Here's the nice optic chiasma right here. That's where the optic nerve crosses over, right? Just anterior to the pituitary. And then where is this pituitary located? Where do you find it? It's in the sphenoid bone. Remember the cella turcica? There's a nice fossa in the cella turcica, in the sphenoid bone called the cella turcica. And the pituitary gland, how many colors do you see right here? You see two. So there are two main parts to the pituitary. Sometimes we call the pituitary the hypophysis, meaning below the hypothalamus. So there's an anterior lobe and a posterior lobe. And what color is this posterior lobe compared to the brain? It's very similar, right? So the posterior pituitary is really neuronal tissue, and so we call that the neurohypophysis. And then over here, this is actually a different embryologic origin. This is from epithelial tissue. So this is true endocrine tissue right here. So it's an endocrine. So this is what we call the adenohypophysis. Adeno, guess what adeno means? It means gland, like an endocrine gland. So an adenocarcinoma would be a glandular kind of carcinoma. Okay, so the anterior is glandular tissue. The posterior is really neuronal tissue. But nonetheless, the pituitary secretes hormones or secretes signaling molecules into the blood, and a signaling molecule that's secreted into the blood, where it's transferred to a different site, where it binds to a receptor to produce a specific response, is what kind of gland? An endocrine gland, right? So these are indeed endocrine glands. And so I don't want you to know all these different parts of the pituitary, like we see, like the pars, distalis, tuberalis, etc. But I do want you to know anterior, posterior, and a third one right here, the infundibulum, which is the bridge between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And this bridge takes two different functional strategies to get information from the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland. And one is a vascular system and the other is a tract. So everybody knows what a blood vessel is, but what about a tract? What the heck is a tract? What's a tract? It's a bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system, right? And it's white matter because they're myelinated axons. And the myelin gives that tissue kind of a whitish look to them. Okay, so the way hormones are released from the posterior pituitary is that these hormones are produced in cell bodies in the hypothalamus, in particular the paraventricular and supraoptic nucleus in the walls of the hypothalamus. Here is the third ventricle, so it's the wall of the hypothalamus. And then they send axons down through the infundibulum, and when action potentials reach these axon termini right here, then these neurons release antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. We're going to talk about these effects in just a little bit. So action potential. So these hormones are synthesized in these cell bodies and by axoplasmic flow reach the axon terminus, but they're not released until an action potential, right, depolarizes this axon terminus. They're released in the posterior pituitary, and they're picked up by this capillary bed, because remember, things can only enter or leave a vascular system via a capillary, right? That's the function of a capillary, is for exchange. And then ADH and oxytocin go everywhere in the body where they can change the physiology of certain cells in the body. What would we call those cells, and what do they have to have? They have to have a receptor. If cells have a receptor, what do we like to consider them? Their target tissues or target cells. If they have a receptor, they'll be sensitive to levels of these hormones inside the blood. Okay? So ADH stands for antidiuretic hormone. Sometimes it's called vasopressin. So vasopressin and ADH, look, it's a little bit confusing on this slide, are what? They're synonyms of each other. Okay? They're synonymous. ADH and vasopressin. Okay. So, to control posterior pituitary hormones, there are these myelinated axons, that's a tract. So the name of that tract going through the infundibulum is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. All right, so we just combine the name of the pituitary, which is hypophysis, with hypothalamus right here, put an O between those words like we do in anatomy, and that completely describes where this tract is, right? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. That's how secretion of posterior pituitary hormones happens. Now, the anterior pituitary is a little bit different. There are no axons that go from the hypothalamus directly into the anterior pituitary, but there are blood vessels. So let's look at this scheme right here. There are cell bodies in the hypothalamus, and when they become stimulated, right, the action potentials go down to the axon terminus, and then these things right here secrete a hormone. These are what we call releasing factors from the hypothalamus. Releasing factors are picked up by a capillary bed in the median eminence, and I don't know if I want you to know that particular term, but in a site of the hypothalamus which is very inferior, right, as opposed to superior. And then these hormones, which we call releasing factors, travel down by this blood vessel to the anterior pituitary, where there's a second capillary bed. And those releasing factors then diffuse out of the circulatory system and bind to receptors on the cells of the anterior pituitary, which then cause the anterior pituitary to release other hormones. All right, so let's focus on the hormones that the anterior pituitary releases, and then get back to these hormones up over here in the hypothalamus. Okay, but here is an interesting circulatory system. What's the usual circulatory system? How does So starting with blood in the heart, how does it make a complete circulation through at least one side of the heart? What kind of blood vessel takes blood away from the heart? An artery, okay? So blood flows from an artery into a capillary. What happens in a capillary that makes it special? Exchange, yeah, diffusion takes place, right? And then from a capillary, what happens? Goes back to the heart via a vein. That's the usual kind of circulatory system. But in a few places in your body, you have a little bit more sophisticated circulatory system. It's a special delivery system. It's like door-to-door delivery system. Instead of having one capillary bed, you have two. So here is an artery that feeds this capillary bed. Capillary bed number one, releasing factors are absorbed or diffused into the circulatory system. These capillaries then anastomose and form a vein, which takes blood directly to a second capillary bed. Not directly to the heart, but a second capillary bed. So these blood vessels here that interconnect the two capillary beds is called a portal system. So a portal system is just the blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back to back. So this is special delivery. It's taking these releasing factors directly to the anterior pituitary, where they then diffuse out of the blood and signal various cells inside the anterior pituitary. Okay, and then here's a vein that takes blood back to the heart. So that means very small quantities of releasing factors have to be released because it doesn't get diluted in the whole circulation. It goes directly to the anterior pituitary. Okay, and in here we have we have various hormones that are going to be released by the anterior pituitary. And here's a nice slide, good exam figures, that shows what the hormones are for the anterior pituitary. But before we take a look at these, what about the posterior pituitary? Let's just go over that really fast. How many hormones from the posterior pituitary? There are two, which are? Vasopressin, also known as ADH, and the second one is oxytocin. Okay. Now, for the anterior pituitary, there are six trophic hormones, and a trophic hormone is a hormone that's necessary to support the development, growth, and secretion of hormones from another gland someplace in the body. Okay, so there's a hormone called prolactin from the anterior pituitary that goes to the breast that causes development of glandular tissue in the breast. And this glandular tissue produces milk. All right, so prolactin then allows the breast to produce milk. Without prolactin, then the breast won't ever be able to secrete any milk. And that would be what? An exocrine function of the breast, because it has ducts. So prolactin is responsible for that. All right, there's also growth hormone. All right, and growth hormone goes to adipose tissue, muscle, and bone and promotes growth. So it allows the absorption of amino acids and the incorporation of amino acids into proteins. That's growth hormone. Sometimes we call that GH. And prolactin, sometimes we call that PRL. So these things are abbreviated. All right, another hormone is thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary. And where does that go? What's the target tissue for thyroid-stimulating hormone? That is the thyroid gland, right? So there are receptors in the thyroid gland for TSH, and that causes the thyroid gland to grow and maintain itself, but also to secrete thyroid hormone. Okay, so thyroid-stimulating hormone causes the thyroid to grow and release thyroid hormone. Adrenal corticotropic hormone, ACTH, it goes to the adrenal gland. What part of the adrenal gland? It's in the name. The cortex, right? And it's a trophic hormone, so that maintains and causes the adrenal cortex to grow, but also to secrete hormones, right? Similar to the mode of action of thyroid-stimulating hormone. And then here are the last two. The last two are called gonadotropins because they cause the gonads to mature and develop and secrete hormones. And what the heck is a gonad? It's a sex organ. Okay, and it produces gametes. What's a gamete? Like an egg or a sperm cell, okay? But a gonad can also secrete sex steroids. So give me an example of a gonad. There are two kinds. Yeah, there's male and female. So female would be ovary, male would be a testes. So these gonadotropins go to these gonads right here and maintain their function their functional status for whatever they do, which is what we're going to talk about next. The two gonadotropins are follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. Follicle-stimulating hormone, okay, in the female causes the maturation of an egg, okay, a follicle which contains an egg, so that once a month a mature follicle will ovulate an egg, which is then, you know, available for fertilization. Follicle-stimulating hormone also causes the release, because a follicle is growing, of estrogen. Right? FSH in the male, on the other hand, causes the production of spermatocytes, which is the male counterpart, right, is the male gamete counterpart to an oocyte or an egg in the female. LH, on the other hand, causes the ovulation right at mid-cycle of an egg from a mature follicle. So there's a big spike in LH. This is the very last chapter in the class where we look at exactly what's going on right here. But I do want you to know these gonadotropins come from the anterior pituitary. LH in the male stimulates the production and secretion of testosterone, which is the male sex steroid. Just FYI, there are two important female sex steroids. There's only one in the male, but there are two in the female. One is estrogen that I mentioned, and the other is progesterone. And later on in the class, we'll see how those two switch around and how that relates to the ovulatory cycle and menstrual cycle. But for right now, I want you to know gonadotropins are both FSH and LH. All right, so how is the release of these anterior pituitary hormones controlled? Okay, it's controlled by the hypothalamus, right? And the hypothalamus releases other little hormones called releasing factors, which then go through the portal blood vessel right here, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel, leaves the capillary system in the anterior pituitary, which then stimulates the release of these various hormones right here. So here is just a slide. We talked about this slide already. Okay. Release from anterior pituitary hormone controlled by hypothalamic releasing hormones, and sometimes they're inhibitory hormones. Okay, and they travel through this hypophyseal blood vessel right here, this portal blood vessel. All right, and so now I think I want to write something on the board just to get the scheme down a little bit. So let's see. I was going to bring a marker. Oh, I hope I have a marker here that you can see. All right, so here is, oh, nice. I can see it. Hypothalamus right here. And then, so I'm going to kind of just put this in a circle like this. And then I'm going to put pituitary gland, right? And so we're going to be talking about all those trophic hormones. What part of the pituitary releases those trophic hormones? Anterior pituitary, that's right. Posterior pituitary, just ADH and oxytocin. So here is anterior pituitary. And we said anterior pituitary releases one kind of hormone called thyroid-stimulating hormone. And what's the target tissue for thyroid-stimulating hormone? The thyroid gland. Right, so I'm going to kind of make it look like a nice butterfly, because it kind of looks like a butterfly right here. Causes the thyroid gland to grow and develop and to secrete thyroid hormone. Right, so thyroid hormone, okay, we're going to call T3 and T4 for right now. We'll take a look at that. Right, so how does the anterior pituitary know to release TSH? Because the hypothalamus is going to release something called TSH, what? RF, releasing factor, which goes to the anterior pituitary. How does TSHRF from the hypothalamus get to the anterior pituitary? Via what? Is it an axon? Is it via a tract or a portal blood vessel? The portal blood vessel. Maybe if I go back, it will help. Yeah, see, there's that portal blood vessel. See the portal blood vessel right here? Okay. So that's how TSHRF gets to the anterior pituitary. What else is secreted by the anterior pituitary? How about ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone? And where does ACTH go? goes to the adrenal gland, so there's a nice adrenal gland. But does the whole adrenal gland have receptors? What part of the adrenal gland? Only the cortex. So here's the medulla right here. So it goes to the cortex. Remember, the cortex is the superficial region of any organ. Okay? And then the adrenal cortex, which we haven't talked about yet, but we will release things like aldosterone and cortisol. All right? But the question, though, is how does the anterior pituitary know when to release ACTH? Okay, because the hypothalamus has to tell it by releasing factors. So let's put ACTH, -RF, which goes to the anterior pituitary. Right? So do you see this kind of scheme that's working right here? All right, can we do that one more time? Just for fun? There are things that maintain the gonads. What do we call those things? Gonadotropins, all right? And so we're going to abbreviate that GN for gonadotropins. That's the same thing as what? LH and FSH are gonadotropins, and they go to the gonads, right? I won't draw that in. So how does the anterior pituitary know when to release these gonadotropins? Because the hypothalamus is going to tell them by releasing what? GN, gonadotropin releasing factor. In some books, you might not see releasing factors, you might see releasing hormones. So if you see an RH, that's going to be exactly equal to what? RF. Releasing factors and releasing hormones are always from the hypothalamus right here. And they cause the release of the corresponding trophic hormones from the anterior pituitary. Okay. I don't think we have to do all six. I think you see what's happening right here. All right, so let's go to next slide. Here is an example, okay, of what do we have on this slide? We got hypothalamus. Not as nice a diagram as what I drew on the board, but pretty close. You got hypothalamus right here. Okay, and then here's the anterior pituitary, and then here are the gonads. So the hypothalamus is going to control the anterior pituitary by releasing what? Releasing hormones or releasing factors. Oh, your book doesn't use releasing. What did I use? I use releasing factors. Your book uses releasing hormones. It flips back and forth depending on what book you read. Okay, all right, and our book might even use both. Okay, so GnRH goes to the anterior pituitary. How does GnRH from the hypothalamus get to the anterior pituitary? Eventually you'll have to know the name of that thing, but just tell me generally. A portal blood vessel, right? Because there's a capillary in the hypothalamus, there's a capillary in the anterior pituitary, so GnRH gets into the circulatory system in the hypothalamus, leaves when it gets to the anterior pituitary, and then GnRH causes the release of FSH and LH. And then how does FSH and LH, which are gonadotropins, how do they get to the gonads? Through the circulatory system, right? Just like any other kind of hormone, because there are capillaries in the anterior pituitary, same capillaries that GnRH leaves, goes to the gonads where they bind to receptors on those cells. And then those cells will do their thing via spermatogenesis or oogenesis, or they might release sex steroids as well, right? Like estrogen and androgens. And androgens is just the general name for testosterone-type compounds, right? So it's a male sex steroid. So these are going to float around in the blood and cause various effects like secondary sex characteristics to develop or control menstrual cycle, things of that nature. All right, so these sex steroids can then, since they're in the bloodstream, they go everywhere. The hypothalamus has receptors for estrogens and androgens, right? And as estrogen increases in the blood, it's going to cause a diminution of secretion of gonadotropin-releasing hormone. All right, so what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop. And what is a negative feedback loop usually maintain? Yeah, homeostasis, right? So this maintains the proper level of these sex steroids in the blood. So this typically is what we call a long feedback loop, right? But these hormones can also feed back to the anterior pituitary, causing a decrease in secretion of FSH and LH. This right here is what we call a short loop feedback. All right, so there can be long loop feedback and short loop. And sometimes in your book, it mentions that FSH and LH, oh no, this is what it says in your book, that when the hypothalamus releases GnRH, this GnRH can feed back right to the hypothalamus in a negative feedback loop, then decreasing further release of GnRH from the hypothalamus. And sometimes we call that it doesn't say it in your book, but actually we call that an ultra-short feedback loop. All right, so here I see what? Long feedback loop, a short feedback loop, and if the hypothalamus has receptors for GnRH, right, this is what we call an ultra-short feedback loop. That's probably a better way of thinking about it than what they say in your book. Now, under certain circumstances, these feedback loops can switch from positive feedback to negative feedback. So in this particular case, okay, one particular case is when in the female, during the ovulatory cycle, an increase in estrogen feeds back to the anterior pituitary, but instead of negative feedback, it will be positive feedback. So if it's positive feedback, what's going to happen to the anterior pituitary? It's going to increase the secretion specifically more LH. LH will increase. It causes an increase in estrogen, which feeds back positively, which causes an increase in LH. All right, so there's this huge spike in LH, and that's going to cause ovulation. So that's why we say LH in the female causes ovulation, because the nature of this feedback loop changes from negative to positive. And then after ovulation, then it switches back to a regular negative feedback loop. All right, so this positive feedback loop that causes ovulation is what? A normal circumstance. That's a normal, healthy, positive feedback loop that operates only for a short period of time, however. All right, so the hypothalamus, what part of your body is the hypothalamus? It's in the brain. Yeah, it's part of your central nervous system, right? So the hypothalamus, so it's loaded with neuronal tissue. So it receives input from higher brain centers that can affect the secretion of anterior pituitary hormones, like emotional content in somebody's life. All right, stress, and it can affect circadian rhythms, menstrual cycle, and adrenal hormones, because these things are all tied together because all these neurons converge on the hypothalamus. All right, let's look at the posterior pituitary. Releases two hormones. We got ADH and oxytocin. Antidiuretic hormone promotes water conservation by the kidneys, which means the kidneys take water out of urine, which will be lost in your body, and puts it back in the blood, and it will maintain the osmolality of blood. Hence, it's an antidiuretic hormone, because what would a diuretic do? Yeah, it would make you urinate, right? The antidiuretic hormone produces a very small amount of urine that's very salty. A diuretic would produce a high volume of urine, which is very dilute, right? It would have the opposite effect, right? That's one effect, but it can also cause constriction of blood vessels. That's why it has its name, vasopressin. And when blood vessels contract in your body, when they constrict, it affects blood pressure. Does anybody have a sense of how it affects blood pressure when a blood vessel constricts? Take a balloon. Squeeze a balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? It goes up, right? So vasoconstriction is a way of maintaining or increasing blood pressure. So that's another effect of ADH. Oxytocin, on the other hand, causes contraction. It's a stimulant of smooth muscle, and in particular, smooth muscle of the glandular tissue in the breast for nursing an infant. All right, so don't forget there are two hormones that are necessary for nursing. One is prolactin for the development of breast tissue, but that's not going to cause milk letdown or ejection, all right, but oxytocin will. And oxytocin, remember, is part of the neural hypothesis, so it receives action potentials from surface receptors on the breast. So when they're stimulated, when an infant is nursing, then that goes directly to the hypothalamus, and then action potentials reach the the ends of those axons through the hypothalamic hypophyseal tract, which then causes the release of oxytocin, causes the ejection of milk from the breast. All right, so sometimes we call that the milk letdown reflex or milk ejection reflex. And then when there's milk on the breast, what happens to the infant? Does it fall asleep? No, it's stimulated, right? Then it's feeding. So there's more tactile stimulation of the breast, which causes more ejection of milk from the breast, which causes more suckling, which causes more milk letdown, which causes more suckling. Here is another example of a positive feedback loop, which again is really normal. So, we looked at two positive feedback loops today. That's sort of interesting. All right, so here is the supraoptic nucleus right here in the hypothalamus. That's what produces ADH, and the paraventricular produces oxytocin, and then those move down to the axon terminus right here, awaiting proper action potentials before they're released. Okay, so that's the posterior pituitary. The adrenal glands are sitting on top of the kidneys, or you could call these the renal organs right here. So these are adrenal, meaning right up on top. And you see it's kind of a complicated organ. It comes from different embryologic origins. The medulla is really, these are like the postganglionic sympathetic cells that release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. And then, so epinephrine and norepinephrine in that case would be considered like a neurohormone. But the cortex also secretes substances, signaling molecules into the blood. And it gets its signal from the anterior pituitary. What's the signaling molecule from the anterior pituitary, which affects the secretion of hormones from the adrenal cortex? That's ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone, right? So ACTH maintains the proper size and function of the adrenal cortex, but also causes the release of some hormones from the adrenal cortex. Two of the main hormones, there's actually three hormones from the adrenal cortex. Right, an example of one would be cortisol, and cortisol and some other compounds are what we call glucocorticoids because they affect what kind of metabolism in your body? Glucose metabolism, right? Sugar metabolism in your body. So it affects utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis, right? So it has a tendency to maintain high levels of glucose in the blood. And aldosterone is the second hormone. And aldosterone is a mineralocorticoid, so it doesn't affect glucose, it affects mineral homeostasis in the blood. And I see two minerals right here. They are sodium and potassium. And is it important that your body regulates sodium and potassium? Why is that? Because they're the basis of membrane potentials and how membrane potentials change into action potentials and how various neurons signal each other, but they're also important for what? Muscle contraction. What's your favorite muscle? Your heart. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you picked that one. So your heart has to have proper concentrations of sodium and potassium, right, in order to operate, right? And aldosterone does that. And I want you to notice, at least by the end of the class, that the effect of aldosterone is opposite for sodium compared to potassium. As aldosterone levels increase, it resorbs sodium from the urine, which means what? It's taking sodium from urine and put it back in the body, so it maintains or elevates blood sodium. It increases body sodium. But what's the effect on potassium? It stimulates the secretion, right? So aldosterone causes sodium to increase, but potassium to decrease. So if you ever see on a board exam aldosterone and you can't quite remember what the correct answer is, you should always look for an answer where the effect of sodium and potassium is what? Opposite. And that's going to be the right answer. I don't know if anybody writes a really trick question and says, right, that they're opposite one way compared to another way. But always look for that answer. All right, the third kind of, and these are steroid hormones. Cortisol and aldosterone are steroid-based hormones. They're lipophilic or hydrophobic. And also the adrenal cortex releases some sex steroids, in particular androgens. All right, that's both in the male and the female because androgens are important for sex drive. And androgens are also important for aggressive behavior. And which gender is more aggressive, males or females? Well, no. obviously females, okay, in my opinion, okay, in the following sense, right? If you're hiking in the woods and you see like a male grizzly bear, right, in one direction, and you see a female grizzly bear with cubs in the other direction, which way are you going to go? Yeah, well, of course you're going to go to the male because you want nothing to do with that aggressive female behavior of a mother protecting their young, right? So I think for sure aggressive behavior is much more evident in females than males in just that one example. Okay. All right, so here's the adrenal cortex. I think in anatomy you learn that there's some different layers within the adrenal cortex. The point of this slide is to show you how steroids can be interconverted with each other, okay? And the basic molecule is cholesterol, right? And if you have too much cholesterol in your body, of course, that's bad because it causes arterial sclerosis, cardiovascular disease, but you can't be devoid of cholesterol because then you can't make things like aldosterone, okay? You can't, which is a mineralocorticoid, you can't make glucocorticoids, and you can't make sex steroids. Right, so your body would be really messed up if that were to happen. So the zona glomerulosa produces mineralocorticoids. A good example of that is aldosterone. So you just might want to circle mineralocorticoid with an arrow pointing to aldosterone, saying that the aldosterone is an example of a mineralocorticoid. So what's it going to regulate? What homeostasis? Sodium and potassium, right, which are minerals. Some good examples of glucocorticoids will be corticosterone and cortisol. They're going to increase blood glucose, right? And again, they all come from cholesterol, and they're interconverted with these different enzymatic processes in the zona fasciculata and zona reticularis. And these intermediates then can be converted into these intermediates, which then become androgens or testosterone. All right, so different layers of the adrenal cortex produce these different hormones. And the three general classes of hormones in the adrenal cortex are mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, and sex steroids. And these sex steroids are what? These are androgens, not female steroids, but male steroids. All right, so that's the adrenal cortex. Adrenal medulla, I think we're pretty familiar with already. These are where those chromaffin cells are. They act like the postganglionic sympathetic fibers. They don't send action potentials anyplace, but when they are stimulated by, they have nicotinic receptors on them. When they're stimulated by acetylcholine from sympathetic cholinergic neurons or the preganglionic fibers, they directly release epinephrine and norepinephrine, which then stimulates the fight or flight response, which in your body you could see as what? Increased respiratory rate, increased heart rate, increased force of contraction, which causes an increased cardiac output, causes vasoconstriction in blood vessels. Oh, what happens to your blood pressure when that happens? But it goes up, okay? And glycogenolysis and lipolysis, which then makes energy available, okay, for your muscles to operate. That just makes ATP available. Okay, that's just a review of the adrenal medulla. Thyroid gland. Okay, it's just located below the larynx. So here's a thyroid cartilage, here's a nice cricoid cartilage, and here's a thyroid gland, mostly anterior. It secretes thyroid hormones. How does the thyroid gland know when to release thyroid hormones? When it's stimulated from the anterior pituitary, when it releases thyroid stimulating hormone. Now here's a good trick question. How does the anterior pituitary know when to release thyroid stimulating hormone? When it receives a signal from the hypothalamus, namely what? Thyroid stimulating hormone, RF, or you could call it RH. I don't really care. All right, and thyroid hormone, we call T3 and T4 because in order for thyroid hormone to be effective, it has to bind an iodine element. And that thyroid hormone, depending on the state it's in, can either bind three iodines or four, hence the name T3 or T4. So T4 literally is tetraiodothreonine, T3 is triiodothreonine. Good thing I remembered that. Okay, that's not too hard to remember. But typically we just say T3 and T4. T3 is the active form inside cells. Okay, that stimulates basal metabolic rate, but T3 is also necessary for development. right, in order for growth hormone to have its effect. And T4 is like the reserve form of thyroid hormone that's floating around in the blood. Now, the interesting thing about T3 and T4, these are lipophilic hormones. And so they don't really like to dissolve in blood, so they have to combine with like a detergent molecule or a carrier molecule in the blood. I think you've seen a slide on that already, okay, that causes the transport. So these hormones have receptors inside the cell, right, nuclear or cytoplasmic receptors. So the thyroid gland consists of circular structures that we call follicles, and the follicular cells synthesize T4, but the inside of the follicle, the center, maybe you could call it an antrum, or the center of the follicle is just a fluid solution that we call colloid, and it's protein rich because these proteins are necessary to keep T3 and T4 dissolved in the water environment inside a follicle. So here are the follicular cells. Here is the interior space, which we call colloid. All right, so iodide is an ion that's found in blood. It's actively imported into the follicles and secreted into the colloid right here. And iodide has to be then converted into iodine before it can be used, right? And then it's attached to tyrosines, which is a kind of amino acid of that carrier molecule that's inside the colloid called thyroglobulin. And so this follicle right here stores a lot of T3 and T4. So that when TSH levels increase, right, then it's going to be secreted both T3 and T4 into the blood. So TSH stimulates hydrolysis of T4 and T3s from thyroglobulin, which then is secreted into the blood. And this is all under the control of various feedback loops that we talked about, short feedback loops and long feedback loops. All right, so here, this might be an exam figure. I can't remember, but it's a good one to know anyway. So here we have the thyroid gland. How is the thyroid gland maintained? What maintains this thyroid gland from regressing, from just disappearing from the body? It receives a signal molecule, a signaling compound, called thyroid stimulating hormone. Where does TSH come from? Anterior pituitary. Okay, so here's the anterior pituitary, here's TSH, goes to the thyroid gland, and of course there are receptors, and then the thyroid gland is going to maintain its proper size and secrete its hormones. What are the hormones secreted by the thyroid gland? And in this example, it's T3 and T4. Okay, now if you have proper iodine in your diet, then T3 and T4 are proper efficacious hormones. They have activity. All right. So if iodine is adequate, right, then this can form a negative feedback loop to the anterior pituitary. And this is just a nice long feedback loop right here. And as it feeds back because it's negative, then it's going to cause what? The reduction of TSH is going to cause the reduction of T3 and T4 in the blood. But when T3 and T4 drop below the set point, then what's going to happen? Anterior pituitary will then start to increase the secretion of TSH until the proper levels of T3 and T4 are maintained inside the body, right? So a nice negative feedback loop that maintains the proper level of T3 and T4. But if you don't have iodine in the diet, then you're not producing a proper T3 and T4, okay? And then it won't feed back to the anterior pituitary. So the anterior pituitary thinks the thyroid gland is not doing its job just because you don't have proper iodine in your diet. So anterior pituitary is going to tell the thyroid gland, well, you better get busy and make some T3 and T4. So what's going to happen to the thyroid gland? It's going to grow and get bigger, and it's going to try its best to make T3 and T4, but can it? No, because there's no iodine in the diet. Right, so low T3, active T3 and T4 levels, there's low negative feedback, so the anterior pituitary is going to secrete excess TSH, which is going to cause the thyroid gland to hypertrophy, which means that it's going to get big, right? And so here is an enlarged thyroid gland, and sometimes you can see this in people. It's pretty rare because it's really easy to treat this condition by doing what? Just by introducing some iodine into the person's diet. This enlarged thyroid gland is called a goiter. And the way you would see this these days is because people traveled, you know, tens of thousands of miles in just a couple hours via airplane. So somebody, you might see somebody in an airport walking around with a big goiter right there, okay, as a result of that. Because they're coming from a country that's really low in iodine in their diet, and they didn't know how to get it treated. Huh? Where do you get iodine? Well, there are foods that are supplemented in the United States in most places. Salt, table salt, is supplemented with iodine. And if you don't wish to have that in your diet, you can go to the health food store and just buy salt that's not iodinated, but then you could be susceptible to goiter. Other foods where iodine is prevalent in most kinds of seafoods. Iodine is very common in the ocean, so if you eat seaweed, for instance, and a lot of products are supplemented with seaweed parts, or fish, shellfish and things like that, then you probably have more than enough iodine in your diet. Now, here's an interesting case. What would happen? What do you think? How would you be thinking? Notice that this thyroid gland right here, what about the hypertrophy on the right side and left side? Sort of equivalent, or is one side a lot bigger than the other? They look, I see it's a little bit bigger than one side or the other, but still pretty equivalent. But what happens if you have one side that looks big over here like this and the other side looks normal? Do you think that could be goiter? Okay, I hear yes and no. Okay, if it's unilateral hypertrophy, then that's probably a cancer in one lobe of the thyroid compared to the other. All right, so that's kind of but if it's low iodine, it's going to affect both lobes of the thyroid gland the same way, and so it's going to be a nice and symmetrical hypertrophy. All right, the thyroid gland also has embedded in it, especially in the posterior parts of the thyroid gland, something called parathyroid glands. And parathyroid is important for maintaining blood calcium homeostasis. All right, so when blood calcium decreases, the parathyroid glands sense that decrease in blood calcium, and parathyroid then releases parathyroid hormone, which has two effects on it. It goes to the kidneys and it causes resorption of calcium from the urine. All right, and when calcium is resorbed from urine, it's placed back in the blood. What's that compared to this initial stimulus? Does it add or subtract? So if the kidneys put calcium back in the blood and the stimulus is decreasing blood calcium, that's what? A nice negative feedback loop that maintains proper calcium levels in the blood. But parathyroid hormone also goes to bone and it causes osteoclastic activity to increase, so bones demineralize and that calcium phosphate, right, ends up as calcium in the blood. And how does that relate to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from the initial stimulus and it maintains proper calcium levels in the blood. So what's more important, to have strong bones or to have proper blood calcium homeostasis? Yeah, blood calcium homeostasis, your body realizes, is much more important, so it sacrifices bones for what? Synaptic transmission. And when we get to muscle, you see calcium is necessary for muscle contraction. Also for what? Maintaining blood glucose levels. Calcium is important because we looked at the liver function on a previous slide. All right, so I'm going to start with this slide next time, and then we'll finish up with one last organ next time. Okay? And if you want to look up calcitonin, that would be maybe handy. So parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium. Take a guess what calcitonin does. It decreases blood glucose. Okay.